So hi everyone, this is the Movies You Love podcast. It's a podcast where I get to sit down and talk with all sorts of interesting people from around the internet, and I don't know if I'll ever open that up to more people, maybe just someone down the street. Maybe I should do that, take my phone out, put up a microphone and be like, what movie do you love? I don't know, am I being too enthusiastic with this introduction? I have no fucking clue. But can I just tell you that the movie that I'm going to get to discuss with my guest in this episode is a movie that I just am so happy I finally watched, because it is so good. It's so good I almost don't want to ever refer to this as the more popular version people always talk about. And we mention it in our discussion when we talk about this movie. This movie is the Jacques Cousteau, I hope I'm pronouncing that right because I suck at French, 1940s Beauty and the Beast. And it's obviously with, well, isn't it, is it obvious? I mean, I guess it's written in the post title, but it's not really obvious because you haven't heard any of that yet. My guest is Andrea Storr, who writes for pussygoesgur.com, and that is a blog which I find constantly interesting. If you guys aren't reading it, I hope that you will take the time to go and give it a look and see if it's your bag of tea. Is that the expression? No, it's really your cup of tea. I'm making so many mistakes because I'm recording this at 2 o'clock in the morning before posting, because I am a lazy person. I had this edited, I had this set up, and then I came to it, I said, wait, let me listen, and oh, there's no introduction. But anyways, I'm rambling. Here it is. So Andreas, and right now I can tell you that I fear of pronouncing your last name. Can you help me out?
Storr.
How you, at this point, I can tell you, have won the lottery of picking the oldest film so far in my series of interviews, beating out The Apartment by over a decade, and asking us to talk about the Beauty and the Beast from 1947. I guess the obvious place to start is, when was the first time you actually ever saw this film, and can you talk about the circumstances around it?
I'm honestly not entirely sure. I just know it was a point of time when my family lived in a certain apartment, so between the age of like 4 and 10, somewhere in there. I'm thinking probably somewhere in elementary school, so probably I was like 6, 7, 8 years old. I saw it mainly just because, really throughout my childhood, my father really liked having me and my two siblings experience movies like that. It's sort of different movies, art films, foreign films, stuff like that. And so, like, we would do things like go into downtown Minneapolis to the few repertory theaters they have there, and see Vertigo, not sure when that was, maybe like 9 or 10 years old, stuff like that. And so one day he brought home a VHS of Beauty and the Beast, and we watched it, and I think it's, I mean, even the introductory scroll there kind of sets it up as being a story, not quite a movie for children, but sort of an appropriated children's story. And so I think it works very much as a movie to expose to children, and it certainly worked really well for me, and I was just kind of really enchanted by it. And so somewhere, yeah, in second or third grade. And yeah, it was just kind of one more little step in my cultural education, I guess, but then also something that I found very entertaining and enthralling at the time.
You mentioned that your father liked to introduce you to films. You bring up names like Vertigo and such. It seems to me like a lot of these films, you even mentioned with Beauty and the Beast, that it starts out with that scroll, which kind of implies that the film doesn't automatically believe that its audience would be just children, or really mm-hmm. children who would get the gist of it. How did these films kind of play for you in that age group?
Well, yeah, I was always, like, if you're talking about sort of like the canon, the great movies, there's quite a few of them. I would say probably most, if not all of them, really are movies that like were at that age as a child. You can't fully wrap your head around everything that's going on there. And sometimes I would say like with something like Vertigo too, just as one example that jumps to mind, just because I saw it in a theater, so it was an especially impressive experience. There are movies where like you can, as a child, kind of follow them on like a plot level. And like, I know that I saw, well, in fact, my middle name is Orson. So that kind of tells you where my childhood was coming from. And I know I saw Citizen Kane and The Third Man, for example, around a similar age. And these are movies where I would say they're all kind of genre movies. They're all kind of entertaining in a very basic, primal, visual, narrative way, where I think kind of no matter the age, when it's something, well, for example, as full of spectacle, really, as Beauty and the Beast. And I think also if you look at, like, a lot of film noir, well, I watched a lot of horror movies, a lot of Universal horror, a lot of Godzilla movies, stuff like that. These are all movies that really, I think as an adult, I get so much more out of, but as a child, it was so easy for that groundwork to be laid of seeing these for the first time. A lot of Hitchcock, because they're movies that are also, I guess, visually oriented and like oriented around these really kind of timeless, very easily consumed genre stories, where whether they're these ones with supernatural elements in them or crime and betrayal. I don't really know if there's an age at which I can remember not at least just getting some little essence of that. And so, like, this is a movie where I know that the first time I saw this, I only got like the tiniest bit of the surface, but just from that, and we can definitely go a lot into with this movie. I feel like I was getting an idea of sort of what cinema is, what really makes a movie.
Are you? I'm kind of flustered trying to catch the grounding that I was looking for to coming to this question. You bring up a lot of things which to me like speak of a child way past their age group trying to delve into realms of cinema. I mean, you talk about the horror cinema, you talk about foreign, you talk about Hitchcock. I just can't wrap my brain around an 8-year-old just coming to me and going, "Have you seen Jimmy Stewart Be That Awesome?" And I am now jealous of your childhood, childhood.
I'm pretty grateful for it. And yeah, the fact that I certainly knew who Jimmy Stewart was and was very fond of him at that age, too. It's definitely something I don't take for granted. And of course, I wasn't talking about and thinking about movies and my experiences of them in the same way then that I do now. But at the very least, I was just like, Dracula's so cool. I want to watch, I don't know, Harvey, It's a Wonderful Life, that kind of, Cary Grant, Humphrey Bogart, stuff like that.
But getting now more directly into the film of the Beauty and the Beast, it's, for a film like this, I mean, it's so easy to know that when you mention the Beauty and the Beast, 90% of the crowd are going to be talking about the Disney animated feature.
Mm-hmm.
How do you try and sell people on watching the 1947 French, completely costumed black and white version of this story? Or do you just ignore those Disneyites and just continue treading forward?
Well, I mean, I really like the Disney version myself too. So, it's one of these tricky things where like the name has been so thoroughly taken by this newer kind of, I guess, milestone of our collective, like the childhood of all people in their 20s now. And so, or probably 30s too. And So it is kind of difficult. There's a lot of sort of similar situations where, like, you say a title and, oh, the remake, of course. But with this, I don't know, I guess if I were hypothetically trying to sell it to someone who'd never seen it before, I might casually mention that it's very different, but I would certainly emphasize, the sheer wonder of it, the fact that it's going for a lot of very different things, and I think that the Disney version does a lot of things very admirably and beautifully. It certainly has better songs than this version, and I guess sort of funnier voice acting, stuff like that, better animation, just in terms of being so very different. Whereas with this one, it's definitely going for something a lot more subtle. I hesitate to say, like, deeper, because that might be a little just sort of elitist in that, like, the Disney version certainly does plenty of very deep things. But it's going in kind of different, maybe more mystical, I don't know, sublime, arcane directions, something like that. Which I suppose is how I would probably start a pitch of this movie.
So, this is actually the first time that I'm watching this movie, and I remember it came to my mind like around a couple of years ago, and I meant to see it, and I thank you so much for giving me that nudge to finally watch this movie.
Awesome.
Because this film is, to call it a visual pleasure would be an understatement. There are so many elements. I can just think of the first time you go into the castle, the mansion, and you can see all of these candlesticks being held by these arms, you know. And for, I hate to keep bringing it up, but in the back of my mind, I still have the 1991 Beauty and the Beast, where you can think of the candle who is singing, and you. Part of you wants to say, okay, this is probably because it was the 40s and they couldn't do it any other way. But at the same time, the visual representation of all of this way seems so gorgeous as you go through pieces of the mansion and you see more and more humanized, static elements.
Yeah, where like the castle seems to be coming alive very organically around either Belle or her father.
Yeah.
And it is funny because we all, of course, coming to this, and maybe even me the first time I saw it, I'm not sure when I saw the Disney version versus this. But of course you have the singing, eating utensils and furniture and, table settings and everything in your head when you see like the hand on the table. But yeah, I guess it's just sort of, I don't know, I feel like you can appreciate them both on very different levels. And, in this version, of course, Cocteau is sort of very much working with limitations. I've just been listening to the Criterion Collection audio commentary by, again, Christopher Frayling, and he talks about how Cocteau even sought out effects that would look a lot like Georges Méliès, like sort of prehistoric cinema. So kind of to have it be as antiquated and simple in the special effects as possible, which ends up paying off remarkably when you actually see it on the screen.
It definitely does. There's even more to what they're talking about with this film in how Cocteau tries to represent magic. I mean, there's, you talk about Méliès, and he was definitely someone of magic, someone who believed that filmmaking was magic. And there's something that I found very interesting watching this film for the first time, which is something that I always kind of notice in movies, where they take note, they send it to us up front saying, this is a film, this is fictitious, we're making this up. And they do it just by such a simple thing of the opening scene shot of this movie. Before you even get to that scroll, I saw someone just having the clapper going, we're going to go, this is scene one. And that kind of just acknowledges the artifice that we're going to be watching at this point. How do those kind of things play for you in film, and especially in this movie, which kind of asks for you to have that childlike wonder no matter what age you are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's very much a strong meta aspect here. It's very sort of meta-cinematic, meta-theatrical, meta-fictional in general. And I have kind of an embattled relationship with meta-ness in film a lot of the time, just because so often it can seem either ostentatious or pointlessly ostentatious, and people interpreting movies in meta ways often seems just very frustrating and very sort of needlessly navel-gazing. But here, it's very much up front, as you point out, and Cocteau clearly wants to sort of frame this as a fairy tale and as a movie. And it's actually sort of one of the first things that jumps to mind when I try to sort of vocalize why I love this movie, is because it's really a movie about sort of the joy of creation and magic and artifice and filmmaking. And yeah, I really love how it's sort of this meta fantasy. It's a movie that's as much about the character's engagement with the magic that they experience as with our engagement with the magic that we see on screen, and about very much the possibilities, the potential that are that just a visual art, really, of what you can create with a camera and just a handful of sort of simple parlor tricks.
So, one of the things I always like to look at, because especially with a film like this where you talk about having seen it as a child, is firstly, how does this movie change for you over the years of watching it? I assume that being the film that you talk about so avidly, you're on view number. I'm guessing you can't even tell at this point.
Yeah, well, I don't rewatch movies too often, so I've probably seen it maybe half a dozen times in my life, really. Well, with one or two of them in the past week now. But it is something that I do revisit sort of every few years, I suppose, partly just because it is so bottomless, really. It's just thinking about it over the past week or two. It's a movie that I really feel like Cocteau is kind of inviting you to kind of enter it from whatever angle you want to. So it's a movie that you can kind of approach through any one of his techniques, his scenes, characters, where we have, sorry, I'm trying to figure out exactly. It's so open-ended. And so magical. Sorry, I just need to clear my mind for a second. Is that okay?
Sure. That's sure.
I don't want to fill up the podcast too much with throat clearing. See, as I come back to it every so often over the past, I guess, 10, 15 years, it's a movie there's very much just this open invitation from Cocteau for you to just kind of come on in. The movie itself is kind of this magic castle. And, it's one where seeing it then, I was first taken in by the candles that you mentioned, the hands and the castle coming terrifyingly to life, and the statues with the moving eyes and the smoke pouring out of their mouths. And so that was sort of first what gripped me, and why I suppose this movie has stayed so deeply in my mind through all these years. But then coming back to it, and now, of course, I suppose after going through college taking a handful of art history classes, there's so much more that seems to kind of open itself up to me, like a blossoming flower or something, just that now I can see, like, Cocteau's ties with the surrealists and how he sort of employs quasi-surrealist imagery in this movie, and how there are all these different little possible layers of meaning all sort of flattened underneath just this very gleaming magical surface. And there's just kind of a whole bag of tricks, and it's so fun, which is another reason I keep coming back to it, because it's as far from a punishing movie that I can imagine, where, like, it's full of not only visual pleasure, but it's just very much engaging as a fairy tale, but as a fairy tale that's, well, I wouldn't want to say more than a fairy tale, because fairy tales are, there are a lot in the first place. I love fairy tales, but it's kind of this very multi-layered visual work, and kind of in Cocteau engaging with just so much of artistic history through what is technically kind of a story for children. And so, yeah, there's just really so much going on that there's no way I could have known about or seen as a child that I feel like expands my enjoyment of it. But then also, yeah, that, I don't know, it's become more fun, really, I feel like, as I've grown, and become more impressive and sticking itself more in my mind as sort of this meaning gets appended to all these strange and baffling images. And as now, like, of course, none of the first few times I'd seen it had I also seen Polanski's Repulsion. Are you familiar with it?
I know of it. I've yet to actually see it.
Because it has an image that Polanski kind of took right from Beauty and the Beast of Catherine Deneuve wandering down this hallway that's full of these arms sticking out of the wall, and it's sort of an expressionistic representation of her basically fear of male sexuality and her fear of these groping arms. And now I have that added little film historical footnote in my mind that I can, where I can sort of go back, and now I can watch this movie and see as Belle goes down the hallway that there's even kind of a hint of what Polanski found, what he appropriated that image for in this original movie. So it's, I suppose it's just like any movie that I saw in childhood, where now that I know more about movies and life and the world in general, I see a lot more.
It's interesting that you bring up the sexuality angle, because I was reading a few articles, especially one essay by, oh, I have his name right here and I'm about to muck it up. One essay by Jeffrey O'Brien, which is featured on...
Is that the Criterion, I think?
Yeah, sorry?
Is that on the Criterion website?
It is on the Criterion website. The essay titled Beauty and the Beast, Dark Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And he brings up the notion of the sexuality, where you can see her stepping away from Avenon. And at the same time, you see her moving towards the beast, who she never ever really sees in a sexual manner, but you see these hints at sexuality, where you see them talk about him hiding his eyes, or her allowing him to drink from her hands.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that, which all hint towards sexuality in the same way that fairy tales hint at everything else that they go towards.
Absolutely.
How, I mean, even if we get into talking about the magic in this film as it's played, and I mean not just the mansion, but all of these things that the beast has and uses throughout the film, how do all of these fairy tale elements play for you looking at it now?
Well, yeah, that's definitely, I think, an important aspect that, of course, as a child, I would have had no idea about. But looking at it now, and of course having also seen a while ago Cocteau's earlier film, Blood of a Poet, and knowing sort of more about, I guess, the big surrealist artistic project, that it's easy to see how Beauty and the Beast is also a very erotic film, just in this sort of very subtle, I don't even know if I'd say veiled, but kind of transmuted way, where, like, you mentioned the scene of the Beast sipping water, and I was just looking at that earlier, and it's where he's sort of bending over and drinking water from her hands like a cat and lapping it up. And it's sort of this incredibly erotic image in just this very strange way and within sort of seemingly a child's fairy tale. And it's just, I guess once you start to notice it, kind of overwhelming. Not that the film's entirely about sex, of course, but just that it's one of the many aspects of, I guess, the human experience that Cocteau gets in here, where we have the Beast, who's this very, I don't know, primal, carnivorous, fuzzy, inhuman creature, is, and the makeup, I really can't praise enough. It's just so amazing every time. When I was listening to the audio commentary, mentions that they suspected Cocteau and his crew may have been a little bit inspired by werewolf movies, like The Wolfman with Lon Chaney. And it's funny to see that. And of course, werewolf movies all have their own little erotic aspect. And I feel like Cocteau kind of plays that up here, in that this is very much a movie about the Beauty and the Beast falling in love, the woman and this creature that's not a human being, but still they're very attracted to each other. And he's his prisoner, and he keeps intruding into her bedroom, and he keeps kind of hunching over her, and he's smoking after he kills. And there's just so many just very, very mysterious and very, I guess, kind of verbally inexpressible things just going on with the Beast, when he's just with Jean Marais underneath this really, really heavy makeup and his ears twitching and sensing the presence of meat whenever he goes after a deer. And I don't know, there's just it's hard to draw a reading, like a really simple linear reading of what this all means from the film for me, so much as just like I'm so drawn into what Cocteau's doing with just these bodies and physicality. And that's another reason why I'm so impressed by just the effects, which is that, like, we have the hands coming out of the walls. It's this impossible image, but it's also very, very physical, I guess I'd say manual in terms of the hands, and handcrafted, fleshy. Just there's very much a sense of human bodies at work in the movie, and that's, I guess, part of why the movie doesn't age for me, but it only gets, like, I guess the movie was childlike when I was a child, and now it feels very adult in all these fascinating ways. It's just kind of a portal into this world of transmutations and transformations, and a world where of the Beast's enchanted castle, where the way that human bodies work in our world, or, you know, in the village where Belle comes from, isn't quite how human bodies work there, isn't quite how statues and candles work there. Everything's just a little bit off and different, and I would say more powerful and more special, and it's the world of art and film and magic, and I suppose sexuality too.
To take a step away from the mansion for a moment, because while I feel like that section of the film warrants the most discussion, there is this other element of over at the farm, and I wanted to talk mainly about the sisters.
Sisters are very fun.
And the family portrayal, because that is something which is one of the many things which is left out of later adaptations of this story.
Mm-hmm.
How does that element play out for you in this film?
Yeah, I guess, well, it would be doing it a little bit of an injustice, but I guess I could start by saying that it's kind of because the farm she comes from, because her family is so blah, so bourgeois and boring, and, well, poor but whiny and wishing that they were richer, is part of why the castle is so magical. It's this extremely stark contrast between the world, I would say basically the world that we know, even though this is, I suppose, like 18th century rural France. It's more or less the same as the one we know of family and debts and obligations and suitors and whatever. Having to work and having to mop up after less grateful people. But at the same time, I feel like there's still a lot of interesting stuff going on at that house. Of course, yeah, I kind of love the sisters, just how, well, it's funny, even though so much of the movie is so complex and so going back and forth in these very, I don't know, kind of, it's slippery, like quicksilver, like, you can't quite get a handle on the meaning, but at the same time, Cocteau's still engaging with this kind of fairy tale morality, where we have Belle is good, the sisters are evil. And they're so purely evil, and it's pretty enjoyable to watch because they keep snipping and whining about every possible thing. They lie whenever they can. They could not be less grateful. They could not be more proud and more insistent that they're better people and more deserving than Belle, because she's basically just a commoner, even though she's their sister, which it's very funny. It's kind of like, I suppose, the comic relief villains that populate a lot of Disney movies. And it's the same kind of sort of broadly drawn caricature. Felicie and Adelaide, they could be cartoon characters. But they're still just very entertaining. And even though we never quite get to see them brought down a peg, but at the same time, seeing them degrading themselves by putting onions on their eyes in order to fake cry, and seeing themselves turned into an old woman and a monkey in the enchanted mirror. It's all really, anything bad that happens to them is very gratifying. And so, yeah, I don't know if I can make quite as interesting of claims about any kind of broad artistic meaning for the sisters so much as just like they're where Belle's coming from, and they're just very entertaining to watch on screen.
One thing that I saw in this film when I was watching it, the thing that actually propels the story further is the father, and the question of the family's financial position. When you see him going out into the night to go and try and deal with his business, and then that's what ends him up at the Beast's castle. For some reason, it kind of perturbed me how later on in the film, when we come back, we see that the family is still in financial dire straits, and they seem to have absolutely no desire to try and get themselves out of this issue.
Well, yeah, because he goes to the coast to thinking that his ship has finally come in, both literally and proverbially, and thinking that he's going to get the money, but then his creditors have seized it all, and so he doesn't have too much of a choice. And then, of course, all the beast stuff happens, so he's kind of waylaid by that, and then terrified for his daughter's sake. But yeah, there's not really anything much positive to say about the brother Ludovic and the sisters. The sisters are obviously very, very entitled and would be horrified at the idea of working for a living or trying to elevate themselves independently. And the brother just seems like kind of a lazy, like a slacker. He just kind of lies around, screws around with Avenant, and then basically gets the family more and more indebted. So, yeah, they're all kind of bad people, and the father seems fairly hardworking, and someone who certainly doesn't deserve the kind of children he's ended up raising, except for Belle, I suppose. But, they're just these kind of normal people, sad as it is to say, in that we all, I feel like, know or are related to someone along the lines of the sisters and brother. And of course, we like to imagine ourselves as Belle with meeting the prince at the end and having sisters reduced to carrying wedding dress and everything like that, and being servants forevermore. And so, yeah, it's in that aspect, I'd say the movie is kind of as a lot of fairy tales are, and as I'm very glad they are, a wish fulfillment fantasy of Belle finally getting, well, away from what the other Belle in the musical refers to as the poor provincial town, which doesn't seem any more fun in this version, especially because here there's creditors swarming around at every possible opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, if you had to choose between creditors and Gaston, who just wanted to force marry you, what would be the better option?
Yeah, I wonder which Belle to be. But they both end up with pretty much the same resolution as it is. But yeah, I feel like there's definitely some painful realism. As much of a fantasy as this movie is the idea of poverty just kind of swooping in like a vulture and taking everything but the bed. I love that the creditors decide to leave the bed for the father to die on.
Yeah, they say we never take the bed.
They're gonna take everything else, but then again, with his family, it really doesn't seem like they deserve much more, just because the sisters are willing to kill the beast, really, and take away everything their sisters earned through her goodness, and give the key to Avenant. I really love that toward the end, as they're walking around and they've got the mirror and the key and the horse, and just kind of this this image of these really nasty people appropriating all of the beast's, his magical symbols, all of the pieces of his power. And it's only because Belle herself feels sort of pity toward her family, and they kind of exploit her goodness. And it's kind of a... toward the end, at I guess what's roughly the climax, we have all of these really unpleasant siblings, and even Avenant, who it certainly is no Gaston. He's I'd say much more courteous and chivalrous, and actually has more of Belle's best interests at heart rather than just like his own ego. Though he has some of that too, but even he insists he's going to kill the beast and steal everything that he has. It's sort of these the family members all, like, the family members were the representatives of this ugly, unpleasant, poor world that Belle comes from, which is, I would say, roughly our world, and certainly the world of France in 1946, where Cocteau couldn't even afford color film and could barely afford sets and costumes, and was lucky to find a manor to use as the Beast's castle. So he's making the movie in this very poverty-stricken post-war world in the first place. And so I'd imagine that Belle's original circumstances with creditors knocking at the door were no stranger to them then, and I'd say they're no stranger to most contemporary audiences watching it. And as I know, I certainly have to struggle to pay bills every month, and so I can certainly feel sympathy for her family with that. And so there are these the representatives of where she originates, and they're infringing on the magic that she's found. Really, they're pilfering it. They're riding on Magnifique, the magic white beautiful horse, and trying to invade the Beast's property, and it just feels like such a violation. And I suppose within the movie, especially at the climax, since as the Beast's dying, Belle has more important things to worry about. So it doesn't make too big of a deal about that. But that every time I watch the movie, there just feels like something so deeply wrong about that, about the sisters trying to take her pearls and look in her mirror and keep her from going back to the Beast by saying, oh no, you have to stay with us because we love you so much. Just with little mean smiles on their faces as I say it. And it just sort of feels kind of hurtful just to watch Belle almost falling for this and almost giving away the magic that she's found, and the impossible to really fully understand magic of the castle, and let it be taken by her family, poor and needy and greedy as they are. So that's certainly something that I'm sure the first time I saw it, and now the most recent time that I've seen it, always is a little painful to see them taking the key. And it's also one thing with that key, watching it this time, over the past few years, or between now and the last time I'd seen the movie, I'd done some watching and thinking about movies like, well, Hitchcock's Notorious for one, but then also a movie that came out a few years before it, and this, Maya Deren's Meshes of the Afternoon. Are you familiar with that at all?
I'm not familiar with that at all.
It's so it's like a maybe 12-minute long avant-garde short, and it's kind of hugely influential. I think a lot of sort of symbolic and sort of more surreal filmmaking of the past 60, 70 years has sprouted out of it. And like Mulholland Drive is hugely indebted to it, which is a connection that I really enjoy. And so it's just kind of this dreamlike sequence of this woman played by Maya Deren kind of walking through all these mazes around her house and seeing all these symbols pop up and these faces with mirrors in front of them and these knives. And there's also, I believe, a key that keeps tumbling through the ground or tumbling into her mouth. And so watching it now and seeing sort of these things that function basically as like artistic surrealist symbols the Beast even lists them off: his horse, his rose, his glove, his mirror, his key. And watching it this time, I thought, of course, Meshes of the Afternoon, because I don't know for sure if Cocteau had seen or was drawing from that consciously, but it's the same sort of set of ideas where Maya Deren uses the key and the knife as just these images that really encapsulate a lot of just what's going on in the movie, where it's not the kind of straightforward symbol of, you know, the green light at the end of Daisy's dock and the Great Gatsby is the American dream, that kind of thing, but sort of these free-floating symbols that kind of latch onto other things and sort of soak up meaning. And I was thinking the key in Meshes of the Afternoon, the key in Beauty and the Beast, and it's this key that is more than a key. And of course, keys themselves are really, I'd say, obvious literary symbols in the first place, where they're unlocking doors, they're unlocking mysteries, they're introducing us to new things. And so the key here is just kind of it's a physical object on screen, but it's holding in it so much. It's holding in it the Beast's magic and this other world that he represents for Belle, and this whole set of possibilities, and the key as unlocking the door and bringing us into the magical world. And of course, it's literally within the movie, it's the key to the pavilion where the Beast keeps all his treasure. But it's just really, there's so much within this key and this glove. And I love the image of her putting her hand in the glove and turning it, and she's somewhere else. So these are all kind of motifs of discovery and strangeness and going from the normal world into the world of, I would say, Beauty and the Beast as a film, into the world of Cocteau's filmmaking, into the world of really anything different from what we know and experience here, where we're just sitting and talking right now. And so to have Avenant, who's just kind of this, handsome Vulgarian, really, this guy who the Beast eventually becomes, and he becomes the Beast, but who comes from such a different place, where he just sort of lounges around with Ludovic all day, and to have him take hold of the key and ride on the horse, it just feels like such a, I guess, like a contamination. And so, you know, there's just so much, I feel like, that Cocteau, through the particular way that he tells the storytelling, that he tells this story, and through the way that we see Beauty move through the castle, and through the way that objects are shot, and of course, always in under Henri Alicant's camera, under this beautiful light and these shafts of light, and with darkness behind them, so they seem to just be as so often the Beast is when he approaches her bedroom. Just they seem to be in like an abyss. In there's nothing around them. It's just blackness in the background. And so all the objects in the house, and of course the hands holding the castle or the candles, and the statues breathing smoke, they all seem to be more than objects, and I suppose more than body parts in the case of the hands too, where they're just sort of shot in a way that makes them attract meaning like magnets, is how I suppose I think about it. And so when I watch this movie, just the beauty of it, and we were talking about just how much visual pleasure there is going on with the black and white cinematography, also seems to sort of make objects sort of pop out from the background and imbue them with something really sort of special and different, and they're not just props anymore. Like, this is as close to magic as the real world will ever have, and it's on screen.
I mean, I don't think we can think. I mean, we've seen there've been a lot of visually amazing films ever made, but something about that scene in which Belle slow motion runs through the castle, mm-hmm, for the first time just kind of had me.
Yeah, and of course, I don't mean to say that, like, specifically this movie is the closest cinema has ever gotten to magic, but just sort of, I feel like the movie is kind of saying that, like, the way that movies are able to present things is magical, is, like, for all intents and purposes, if we need magic in the real world, this is it, in theaters, which I feel like what Beauty and the Beast is saying sort of on this, meta-cinematic thematic level, is very much largely why I care about movies, why I keep watching and writing and thinking about them. Just sort of, it's my own, like, cinephile ethos or something like that. Which is part of why this movie is so special to me, because I feel like it says it all so very well. And like you're saying, that scene with Belle running in slow motion, and certainly I can't think offhand of a movie that, or I prefer the use of slow motion to what happens in this. I guess we, at this point, after having seen them when her father entered earlier, we just sort of accept them as part of the scenery. But now here she's just running through this house, and it just, everything feels so enchanted. And of course, slow motion is a way of kind of making her motion alien. I'm sorry. Also, can you hear the sirens?
I did hear it. I was trying to figure out what it was.
Okay. It's tornado drill week here. Will that show up in the recording? Do you know, or
it
doesn't matter?
I'll probably hear it, and I'll find it just as funny when I miss tornado warnings.
Yeah, this is Minnesota, so right now it's just all over the place. But anyway, with Belle running in slow motion, and of course, slow motion used by Cocteau here as a means, and I think he uses it later with Magnifique too, of making the motion of a figure across the screen seem different from the kind of motion we're accustomed to, and like, human bodies aren't really supposed to move that way, and of course they only can in a movie. And so it's very, like we've been talking about this whole time, highlighting the moviness of Beauty and the Beast, and just emphasizing this is something that we've put together and that we are showing you, and it's fictional, and it's also magical, and its fiction doesn't take away from its magic in any way. They're kind of, I think for Cocteau, the ideas of fiction and magic are almost synonymous, or maybe instead of fiction, I don't know if just visual artistry as a concept is a better way to say that, but he's just here, especially since it's a fairy tale and since the meat of the story is about, it's kind of this set of metamorphoses and this motion across seemingly impassable barriers from reality into fantasy, and from human into animal, from civilization into wildness. And that's very much what the story of Beauty and the Beast is about, from law and order and what we understand as how people should behave, how objects should behave, how physics should work, into something completely different and something that's not wrong, but is just not quite comprehensible by the standards that we use to judge our world. And this story is very much about moving into that. And so it's just kind of a chance for Cocteau to make use of, to tell this story of how art and how the camera specifically can really do all those things and give us beauty almost floating down these hallways before ending up in that courtyard and then fainting at the sight of the beast. And of course, there we have also this other side to what he's doing here, this very tender but also bestial and terrifying love story that's at the heart of the movie.
So, I think this might be my last foray into the discussion of the Beast and Avenon, but one thing that the film definitely makes blatantly clear, as it literally says it, is how certain things can make a man a beast and a beast a man, and that would be love. Do you feel like mm-hmm. this is just a discussion of versions of Avenon, especially as we see they're played by the same actor?
I don't know if I would say that Avenon is quite equivalent to the Beast and to the prince that the Beast turns into at the end. I think that when I also learned that sort of that was having them be the same person in the end, or having them all three roles be played by Jean Marais, was kind of a conceit that Cocteau came up with that had no place in the original story. And then, of course, ended up kind of in the Disney version, in that Gaston and the Beast are these kind of physical parallels of one another. Yeah, I learned that that Cocteau kind of invented the idea of, well, the whole character of Avenant, but then especially having him and the Beast and the Prince be kind of, in terms of what they look like, one and the same. It's an idea that I would say sort of carries on to the Disney version, in having Gaston and the Beast be kind of physical parallels of one another. They're both these very large, intimidating men, I suppose. But then I don't know if I would say that, like, the Beast and Avenant are quite equivalent or opposites or what. It seems a little fuzzy for me, because certainly we do have Jean Marais underneath that heavy makeup, and then Jean Marais as sort of the vain and dashing Avenant. But I don't know, there seems to be something else going on. I'm not entirely sure. Partly, I think, because one idea discussed in the commentary I was listening to earlier is the fact that Cocteau and Alicant shoot Jean Marais in the most flattering light possible. He's the ugly beast. We see this face full of matted fur and sometimes fangs bared. But he's always sort of his eyes twinkling, and even at the end, as he's dying, the makeup's so beautiful, really. And the Beast, it's kind of funny how the movie is slanted, so that even though the Beast is he's very much a brute and he's very scary. And in fact, sometimes I feel like Beauty and the Beast is a horror movie, especially that moment when he appears at her bedroom door and there's just smoke coming up from him and he's growling and he's just very much visibly a beast. And there's not really any mistaking it, and there doesn't really seem to be a sense of humanity there. He's just been feeding, and it's hard to even picture there as being anything to love at that moment. But at the same time, the film seems to very much skew it by having the Beast be so preferable. And of course, he comes with all this magic, and he comes with this other world, but he also comes, and I think part and parcel with that is the fact that his world isn't just magical, but it is very scary. And when we first see the father entering, that image of that I keep coming back to, because it's just unshakable, of the hands holding the candles, there's a lot going on there where it's enchanting and it's magical, just as the dancing teapots and silverware and everything are in the Disney version. But it's also dangerous. And there's a very real sense of entering a stranger's domain, and the stranger wields kind of unknowable, possibly limitless power, and it's all heralded by these hands with the candles, and you don't know where these hands, who these hands belong to, and I think that's part of why that's so powerful. And not to go too far off track from actually talking about the Beast and Abanat, but I feel like that's that initial image, our first impressions of the Beast's castle, is essential to the idea we end up fully forming of the Beast, where he's this creature under this heavy makeup, and he's a monster, but he's also a man, and there are these two sides wrestling inside of him, and he's tender and sensitive, and very, very carnal, and I would say lovable, but not in like a harmless, affectionate way. He's also just very much got this beast side to him. And so, yeah, the Beast is just, I'd say, well, that Jean Marais is probably the most, the best performance in the movie. I don't think that's too controversial a statement. And the Beast is just sort of the most compelling figure, not just because he's under this makeup, but because him being under this makeup is played in kind of these counterintuitive ways, where he's not just monstrous, and he's not just this romantic figure. It's not, well, he's not really a cuddly monster either, but he's representative of all everything that Belle could possibly ever have in the world, but he's also representative of the fact that Belle trying to have more could result in, I mean, death, getting eaten, whatever you want to imagine could happen to her, or to happen to anyone at his mercy. And it's just all very, I don't know, attractive, but then also frightening. And so it's very double-edged, and I guess not in a way that doesn't seem obvious to me. Like, it's not just the allure of him being a wounded soul, but the fact that he comes with these magical tokens, and that he can die from heartbreak too after she leaves him for over a week. I don't know, everything just feels like all these ideas and emotions, these very, very large, powerful, and also dangerous, possibly life-threatening emotions, and desires and carnality, and they're all put in physical form in the Beast and his magical objects, and also the animals that populate the movie. There's so much going on with animal life here, and I really love it too, because not only does it work symbolically, but it's just very, the screen's often very, very busy, and you just get this sense of a very full world. Where especially like right as the Beast is dying, and you see these swans coming from just off screen and pecking at his body, and they're swans, which is also so very strange. But this is certainly a world with lots of wildlife in it. And then yeah, at the end, when we get the final change, where it's kind of a, I guess, moral turned physical. Dare I say, like, you know, fairy tale, EC Comics style, morality tale ending, where, for trying to transgress the Beast's magical laws, Avenant gets shot, and his face becomes that of the Beast, and so it's sort of you were evil in life, and now you are ugly in death, kind of thing. And then the Beast, well, of course, we have that that effect that I love. I think it's like playing it backwards, where he springs up as the prince.
Yeah, but it's very obvious when you're watching it that they definitely filmed it backwards and they were just falling down.
Yeah, which, of course, also, like the slow motion, it's all these sort of very simple, what you're saying, Melies-esque camera tricks, but they do such an effective job. It always kind of baffles me that, like, this stuff where I know exactly how he's doing it. I mean, if I had a camera, I could probably reproduce it pretty easily now. But it's still such a good job of bringing me into the idea of magic and the idea of sort of different motion, impossible motion, human bodies transported in ways that they couldn't possibly be in real life as signs that there's magic afoot. And so, yeah, we have him becoming, not Avenant, but taking on Jean-Marie's face at the end there. And that, of course, calls to mind, I don't know if you've read about how there's a sort of much discussed anecdote of Greta Garbo in a theater seeing Beauty and the Beast for the first time. And then at the end, after that transformation, saying, "Give me back my beast," out loud in the theater, which I love partly because it sort of goes along with any kind of star image I can have of Greta Garbo as like this strange and kind of alien woman herself, but then also about how part of what's so enchanting about the Beast isn't that he's going to turn into a prince eventually. And it's not, from this movie, I don't so much get the impression of like, the kissing the frog turns into a prince and that's your reward for kissing a frog in the first place. Something like that. So much as, it's almost it really is kind of a letdown for him to, as beautiful as Jean-Marie's face may be, for him to shed all that makeup just because the beast, he's so involving and he's not, I wouldn't call him likable by any means really, but he's just such a powerful figure at the center of this movie. And so then once he's gone, it's a happy ending, but there's just a little bit of a sense of loss there, which I think is a strange little note that the vast majority of fairy tale retellings don't have, and that it's so it's such a last little, I guess it's like a poking us with a pin in the middle of a happy ending, where we can have the prince and the fortune and the happy ending and everything, but you still have to, the beast has to die. And there's something tragic there, because it's the beast that she fell in love with. And so, yeah, I don't know if that quite answered your question, but
I'm not quite sure either. But the answer is still fantabulous in itself. What I find the most interesting is when I was seeing it, is that I didn't interpret it as death. I did interpret it somewhat, not necessarily these exact words, but somewhat in a magical sense, in a sense that this film had presented all of these other things to me, very much like the "she kissed a frog." Not that it's her reward, but the fact that this moment happened, it was a transformative moment for both Avenant and the Beast.
Yeah.
And that it was just a natural progression of those characters in the states they were. And they reached that point, but I had never thought of that point of being actual death.
Yeah, it's tricky. I don't, and it is a transformation and kind of a recovery, I suppose, in that it's like, maybe you could say like, there's the same soul in that body going from the beast to the prince. But at the same time, I guess it's, I guess you could say that really, in the same sense, every change, every transformation is a kind of loss or death. It reminds me, in fact, this is kind of random, but of the fact that the tarot card with the with death on it doesn't just signify death, but change itself and some kind of huge upheaval. And so here, having certainly gone from man to animal a long time ago, now he's going down the other path, or the backwards on the same path, from animal to man. And it's another one of these kind of breaking barriers, just as Belle went from the real world to the magic world and goes from poor to rich, and from humanity to the wilderness. And now he's doing the same thing of going from being the beast to being a man again. And there's just something, there's something lost there, and of course there's something gained there. And I just think that moment, and I love also how Cocteau cuts back and forth between, we have the beast dying and he seems to be at his lowest moment, and he's this very pathetic creature with just this the wet fur all over the place, and his eyes are glimmering, and he seems just like he could not be any weaker. And then we go from there to Avenant, for Avenant's death, and as he falls with the arrow striking him, and turns into the beast himself. And so, yeah, these events, they're intertwined, but at the same time, it's not quite something as easy to parse as just them trading bodies. It's very strange, I suppose, and magical, as I suppose it should be.
Of course.
It's just so kind of endlessly fascinating to me to figure out exactly what's happening in the film's magical acts, because the point of magic is that we can never quite understand it. It doesn't work by real physics and rules and anything we can impose on it. And of course, the movie itself is kind of, it's a story, it's a dream, just as there's so much dream imagery and dreaminess going on in Cocteau's other movies, and most surrealist art, really. And so it's just, these are more events that we can't quite wrap ourselves all the way around. We can't quite put them in a box and explain what they are.
Oddly enough, I don't know why this just popped up in my mind, but I'm curious as to what you think about this. Do you think that if the story of this movie never actually happened, right? If Belle's father never came upon the Beast's mansion, and the family went on as it would have from the beginning, do you feel like Belle would have ended up marrying Avenant?
Oh, yeah, I suppose so. That's an interesting hypothetical.
It's completely aside and unrelated to the film as it is, but for some reason it just popped up in my mind.
But yeah, I suppose, and of course, I would never describe Cocteau's film as a feminist text, and it doesn't seem to provide too great of an out, or really too great of a character for Belle in the first place. I certainly like Josette Day's performance as Belle, but she's kind of curious, intrigued, aroused, frightened, and she almost kind of works as like a viewer surrogate for a lot of it. And there only seem to be kind of two options, and both of them involve some kind of subservience, which is really unfortunate for this Belle, and really different from the Belle that is a sort of more familiar of the Belle who wants to set out on adventures and is inspired by fairy tales she's read. And here there seem to be kind of two options, but one of them, I think, the option of going back to the Beast as she does and taking back the magical objects and going back to save him at least involves this willful self-sacrifice and this turning away from her family, whereas the other option is kind of to stay under her father's roof until she transfers to Avenant's roof, which, and Avenant, like, he's not explicitly a villain, I wouldn't say, and he's certainly nowhere near the measure of evil that the sisters have, but he's still, he's not the Beast, and he doesn't, it's not just that he doesn't have a castle, but he really offers more of the same. He's very familiar to Belle, which is interesting to me, that he just kind of hangs around the house, does some archery with Ludovic, and they know each other very well, and so he does seem kind of like the obvious option. He's the one, well, they're going to marry eventually, and he also doesn't seem to care, especially if her family is wealthy, which they don't seem like they'll ever be again. So, yeah, I suppose that it does seem like, well, she would just have the fate that a relatively poor girl in 18th century France would have, which is to end up marrying her brother's best friend and probably having some kids with him. And however, you can just kind of imagine her pedestrian kind of sad life in this same village until whatever tragically young age people died at back then. So yeah, I suppose I'd probably agree with that.
Anyways, I'd like to thank you so much for joining me today, Andreas.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun.
And that was the episode of the Movies You Love podcast. I mean, I was so happy to have Andreas on. I mean, as I mentioned in the podcast, I've been meaning to watch this film for at least a couple of years. When I think I saw it on the 1001 films list, which I'm kind of using as one of my many, like, whatchamacallit, guidelines as to movies I really should be watching. But of course, I've been too fucking lazy to watch. So I thank Andreas for her time, for joining me, for exposing me to this film. Andreas's writing you can find all over at pussygoesgrr.com, and there's a link in the post if you're unsure as to how many R's go in grr. Andreas is also on Twitter as astoehr, A-S-T-O-E-H-R, at. You can find a link also in the post for that. So, as usual, guys, this is the Movies You Love podcast, and it's all on iTunes, it's all on Stitcher. Go rate, go review it, go vote for it, go subscribe, go enjoy. Just go and love movies. And thank you so much for listening.